The following podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and major plot spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello everybody and welcome back to this 10th episode of the King Zone podcast as part of the Super Podcast and the Super Network group. I am your host, Super Marcy, and with me as always is my trusty co-host, the one who is terrible, the Bead Germain. Hello Bead, how are you?
Hello Marcy, how are you?
Yeah, doing okay. You know, staying safe by being at home.
Exactly. I'm the same as well because, I mean, we're still in stage four lockdown here in Melbourne. But at the same time, though, we're keeping ourselves safe, unlike certain people out there who in the community who don't want to do that, but I digress. but, you know, I'm keeping myself busy here at my little flat, just sort of mixture of still putting things together. Like just the other day, I just started finally unpacking all of my DVDs and Blu-rays from my tub, so I'm about halfway through that, so I should get that done this week, and yeah, that's pretty much it, really. Also been watching some movies as well, and also finally checking out some more stuff on Shudder, since that's now available in Australia.
Yes, I haven't watched too much Shudder yet, just some of the documentary stuff, like the shows, but I will definitely be getting more into it as time rolls on, because we have all the time right now.
Exactly.
But you know, anyone that's doing the wrong thing, I think I might just leave them in a cornfield.
I think so too.
Tish. but we are not alone for this podcast. We continuously just rope in one of our favorites that is on the planet to continuously come on our podcast. Please welcome back Matt Konopka, the killer horror critic. God, I hope I got that right.
You get that right, and I love you guys too. And, you know, if you want to talk about people not doing the things the right way, you know, I do live in the country that coined the term anti-maskers. So
yeah. We have those here in Melbourne too, and they're being a bit of a nuisance at the moment.
A nuisance is a word for it, yeah. You know, I'd personally like to string them all up somewhere in a cornfield myself, but...
here I was thinking, like, if they're so against masks, like, the punishment should be they wear a mask that only comes off when an egg's been implanted in you and it's going to burst from your chest.
Exactly.
Just saying.
Oh, jeez. But it's the times we live in. But as I was on our previous episode, Marcy, of audio commentary with Bad Lieutenant, I was just saying in that episode that, like, the last time the three of us got together was for the amazing commentary that, of course, was Tammy and the T-Rex. And yes. Being that Matt was talking about Shudder a lot, and now that Shudder is finally in Australia, I have to ask Matt, as somebody who definitely is a connoisseur of all things on Shudder at the moment, what would you say, like, since Marcy and I are still going through the app as we speak, what would be some recommendations you could give us to watch on Shudder?
Oh, Jesus.
Especially, well, like, the originals or exclusives or something like those ones in particular.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that I'm going to take credit for willing Shudder into existence in Australia for you guys.
Yes, it was all because of you.
It's 100% my fault. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think of recent stuff that has come out recently. So Host has been a big one. I'm sure you guys have probably heard of it by now.
I actually just watched it 2 nights ago, and I'm not going to lie, it actually legit made me jump quite a few times.
Yeah, no, it's a very creepy film, you know, shot in quarantine. I was very impressed by it. I I'm not one of those who's like, it's the greatest film in 20 years. I'm not one of those people. But I did think it was really good. In Search of Darkness is like a 4.5 hour plus documentary on 80s horror that I highly recommend. It's not exactly going to blow your mind with a lot of new information that you've never heard before, but it is really fun to watch a lot of stars and directors kind of go back and talk about some of their work and experiences. And at the very least, you get a really nice catalog of movies that you can maybe seek out if you haven't seen them yet. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, I actually saw that at a film festival last year, and they played the entire 4 hours in one go. No breaks or nothing. And I was pretty much, as much as I did really enjoy the doco, I was pretty much numb by the end of it.
It's a long documentary.
And it's also worth watching because if you keep a lookout in the closing credits, you may find my name somewhere along there. Because I contributed to, I think, was it like the, was it the Kickstarter campaign or the Indiegogo campaign? I can't remember.
I want to say they had a Kickstarter, but I can't remember for sure.
Yeah. But if you have a look out, you can find my name in the credits of that movie. So I at least have one movie I'm somewhat connected to that's on Shudder right now.
Oh, very nice. And yeah, I mean, I'm mostly just running through new stuff, but I also just want to throw out a shout out to Scare Package, which is a just really goofy horror anthology that's on there that kind of pokes fun at the genre, but in a loving way. You know, it's like, it's probably one of the only horror anthologies out there that's pure horror comedy. You know, like, none of it takes itself too seriously. There's a very neat cameo that a certain fan base will be very excited about in the end of it. So, just full of gore, fun. Just, you know, we need more movies right now that are just fun.
Exactly. And since we have all the time in the world at the moment, with especially here in Melbourne with the lockdown, we'll definitely need a lot of fun stuff to watch, and that's what Marcy and I have been doing a lot in the last few weeks.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's all we're all doing.
Pretty much.
But, I mean, as much as we could talk about Shudder all day, because it's completely awesome, but that is not the topic we're talking about for the show today. Oh,
damn it.
We might do that as another show later on down the track. It's just like an all Shudder episode.
Yes.
But Marcy, what is the topic of this episode of The King's Oath?
Well, I believe this will probably end up being part one, and part two we will do sometime next year, maybe. We are discussing Children of the Corn from 1984. Good year, because me and Bede were born in that year.
Damn straight.
We will also be talking about not just the one movie. We'll also be talking about the TV movie remake, Children of the Corn from 2009. As well as the Dollar Baby short film based on Children of the Corn short story, Disciples of the Crow from 1983. So, if there are those of you who don't know, Children of the Corn, I think it's in, the short story is in Night Shift?
I think it was, yeah.
Yep, the Night Shift anthology.
Yeah, so it is one of the more, I guess, popular-ish stories of Stephen King's short stories. I believe it was first published in Penthouse in 77.
I believe that's correct. Yep.
Yes, and then went into the Night Shift collection. And I'll just say, I think Children of the Corn itself, I don't know what set this whole thing off, but there are like a bazillion sequels.
to say the least.
Yeah, we won't really be discussing those, but we may mention it. But yes, the focus is on the short film, Disciples of the Crow, the 1984 film, and the 2009 film. And I probably will discuss the short story because I just read it before we started recording, and I don't think I've read it for maybe 15 years, so it was a good refresher.
I'm curious how many of your listeners you kind of blew the mind of in, wait a minute, there's a 2009 remake and a short film? Like,
yes.
I'm so curious how many people actually know those exist.
Yeah, it's not just like 20,000 sequels from the original that have nothing to do with the short story.
Oh, nothing at all.
No. But we shall kick it right off. Bede, where would you like to start our discussion?
Well, I think we should start from the big main one, which of course is the 1984 adaptation of Children of the Corn.
Every child is afraid of the dark, the unknown, the nightmare. In Gatlin, Nebraska, that nightmare is in the corn. Stephen King's Children of the Corn.
Praise God! Praise the Lord!
Stephen King, the author of Carrie, The Shining, The Dead Zone, and Christine, an adult nightmare. Children of the Corn.
I'm here, Lord! I'm ready! Come here!
Stephen King's Children of the Corn, an adult nightmare. Coming soon from New World Pictures.
Yes, and according to IMDb, the synopsis reads, a young couple is trapped in a remote town where a dangerous religious cult of children believes that everyone over the age of 18 must be killed. That doesn't really sum up this movie that well.
Or at least the insanity of this movie as well.
Yeah. The other synopsis on IMDb, a boy preacher named Isaac goes to Gatlin, Nebraska and gets all the children to murder every adult in town. A young couple on a road trip stop in Gatlin to report a murder and seek help, but the town seems deserted. They are soon trapped in Gatlin with little chance of getting out alive.
Woo! Sold.
Amazing. I'll run it down. It was directed by Fritz Kirsch, I think is how you say it.
I think that's how it's pronounced. I'm hoping and praying that it is, but yeah. That's what it sounds like based on.
Yeah. So it was written by George Goldsmith based on the short story by Stephen King. It stars Peter Horton as Bert, Linda Hamilton as Vicky, John Franklin as Isaac, Courtney Gaines as Malachi, and R.G. Armstrong as Dell? I don't know.
I think they also mentioned that he's also just known as the old man, so we can just stick with
old
that.
Old man, yes. So, fellas, Matt.
Yes.
Please tell us your thoughts on Children of the Corn. Give us a backstory, have you? Is this a movie you watched often?
You know, honestly, it's not. Like, I do like Children of the Corn, and I just want to kind of throw out there, you know, just to give an idea of, like, how influential of a story this really is. You know, so you mentioned Night Shift, the anthology that this story comes from. And if you look back at that Stephen King book, I mean, it is just loaded with movies that were... Or with short stories that were adapted into feature films. I mean, you've got Graveyard Shift, The Mangler, Trucks, which was made in Maximum Overdrive, The Legend or The Ledge, which was made into Cat's Eye, The Lawnmower Man. Mm-hmm. You know, just so many great stories. But Children of the Corn was always the one that stuck out the most because there's, you know, just the concept of an entire town of children turning on their parents and murdering them.
Yeah,
it's just such an interesting one, and the thing that I like about it is that it's a film that kind of changes for you, I think, from when you're a kid to when you're an adult, you kind of have two different perceptions of it because, you know, maybe this will sound nuts, but like when I was a kid, you kind of watch Children of the Corn. And, you know, when you're a kid, it's a period in your life where adults are always telling you what to do and you get kind of sick of them sometimes,
yeah,
you know, to say the least. And so you watch a film like Children of the Corn and it's not exactly, I hope, going to make you go on a killing spree or something, but it's, but it does kind of have like sort of a weird empowering feeling, I think, for a kid who's just kind of able to look at it and go like, oh yeah, okay, kids can control shit too, you know, like it's, we're more than just being told what to do by adults all the time. And then as you become an adult, you can look back on the film and now be like, you know, okay, now I'm in a period of my life where kids are scary as hell and they freak me.
Yeah.
And I don't have one. And I just think it's interesting how you get such two different kind of outlooks on it, you know, as you get older in life. So, but no, I mean, I like the film as it is. I think it's an interesting concept. It wasn't the first time that, you know, that kids have been the center of a horror film. There were other films before this, such as like Village of the Damned or The Bad Seed and others like that. But I think what really works for this is it goes kind of beyond the whole concept of killer kids and into something a little bit more primal, you know, because this is, I mean, at its core, it's on the surface, it's a film about killer children, but it goes to another level where this movie's really more about influence and the power of persuasion. And, you know, I think a lot of us living in the time that we live in now can certainly relate to those themes.
Mm-hmm.
Terrifying they can be because, you know, you look around the world and you see how really honestly easy it is to manipulate others when there's kind of a lack of access to information, right? So I think on those levels, it's a very effective film. It's one that's very memorable. It's kind of hard to get this movie out of your head, whether you like it or not, you know?
Yeah. I tend to agree. Very much.
I guess for me, I have a weird history with Children of the Corn. Not just this film, but this the entire franchise in particular. Because I'm probably one of those weird... I'm one of those weirdos who has seen nearly every single entry in this whole franchise. But the thing is, I guess with the original one, I remember watching... This was one of the first horror films I remember I watched as a teen. Because I didn't really get into horror films until like I was about 14 or so. Because I used to be really sort of scared of horror films and I wouldn't want to watch any of them. But by the time...
let's just be real. You're still a pussy.
Well, that is true. I mean, I did jump a lot during Host, so that kind of tells you everything. But in terms of this movie, I can't remember exactly when I watched it. I probably would have been about 15, 16 when I first watched it.
Mm.
And at the time, I just thought it was so hilariously bad. I just couldn't stop laughing throughout all of it. And I think I did give it a one. And then in prep for the show, because you and I watched it together, Marcy, over Discord, I hadn't seen it since then. And I definitely have warmed up to it a lot more since then. I mean, I'll say this. It's definitely not a good movie at all. But it is a strangely enjoyable one. And it's a memorable one too, which I think makes it even better because... I mean, there are a lot of things about this movie that are quite memorable. The performances, some of the set pieces and scenes. And also for the fact that, you know, it's also still got that sort of eerie, creepy vibe to it as well. And it also, the mythology behind it is really interesting as well, particularly with this being He Who Walks Behind the Rose. Like, what is this deity that these children worship? Like, is it another version of God, or is it like some kind of demonic force or the devil? Like this film and even the sequels that followed it never really sort of delved into that too much. And I guess it kind of in a way leads up to your imagination. Like, I mean, for all we know, He Who Walks Behind the Rose could be some kind of H.P. Lovecraft kind of creation or something like that. But like, there's a lot of interesting things about it. But like I said, some of the execution is hilarious. Like, one of my favorite scenes, and I think I literally I mean, I was pissing myself laughing the first time I saw the scene, but watching it again the other week, I think I nearly fell out of my chair. It was the scene where Bert and Vicky run over the kid on the road. Because it's so obvious that that is a doll. That is, like, obviously they'd have to use a doll for that scene, but it's just even more obvious. And that when the kid gets run over, it's like the doll's still in the one place and it's, like, not moved at all.
That is not the scene I thought you were going to mention.
It wasn't what I was thinking either.
I thought you were going to mention Courtney Gaines as Malachi just standing out there like, Outlander!
That scene is amazing too. But it's really the car, the run over, the kid being run over, just like I fell out of my chair with that scene. But everything else about this movie is awesome. I think Peter Horton and Linda Hamilton, I think, I'm trying to remember, this came out the same year as Terminator, right? So,
yeah.
I wonder if Linda Hamilton looks back at Terminator and is like, thank God that movie came out.
I would not be surprised, because I think this film came out first before Terminator, so that would make a lot of sense.
Children of the Corn came out in March, I think, and Terminator came out, I don't know, later that year, like October, November, or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
So I just have to imagine, like, Children of the Corn came out, and Linda's just like, oh, my God, this is what my career is going to be now.
Like, she's like, thank goodness I don't have to be known as the woman from Children of the Corn. I could be just Sarah Connor from Terminator.
Right, but, exactly. Thank God.
But that's the thing, like, as I think both Peter Horton and Linda Hamilton, I think they're both solid in the film. Not amazing, but both solid. Especially when you sort of see their characters as Bert and Vicky compared to the remake, which we'll talk about in a bit. But I think they're both fine, but it's really the supporting cast who kind of steal the movie. Like, of course, John Franklin, who we love and adore in Tammy and the T-Rex. he plays, I guess, his career-defining role as Isaac.
...to me in the night, and the Lord did show all this to me.
Praise God! Praise the Lord!
A time of tribulation has come. A test is at hand. The final test.
What has the Lord commanded?
In the dream, the Lord did come to me, and he was a shape. It was he who walks behind the rose. And I did fall on my knees in terror and hide my eyes, lest the fierceness of his face strike me dead. And he told me all that has since happened. He said, Joseph has taken his things and fled this happy place, because the worship of me is no more upon him. So take you his life and spill his blood like water upon the earth. But let not the flesh pollute the corn. Cast him instead upon the road.
And so it was done. Joseph the betrayer was cast out.
And he who walks behind the rose did say, I will send outlanders amongst you, a man and a woman. And these outlanders will be unbelievers and profaners of the holy.
I wish Isaac never came here.
But he's always been here, just like he who walks behind the rose.
And the man shall sorely test you, for he has great power, even greater than that of the blue man.
The blue man! Yes, the blue man!
And just as the blue man was offered up unto him, so shall be the unbelievers.
Make sacrifice unto him. Bring him the blood of the outlander.
Praise God. Praise the Lord. 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 Praise God. Praise the Lord.
And he steals the entire movie. Like, it's a scenery chewing performance, but he has a creepy presence about him as well. Like, I can imagine that casting this character would have been so hard, trying to find the best child actor to play the part. And probably it didn't work out because they had to cast someone who was 24 years old to play this character.
But I think that's why it works so well, though, is because, yeah, you know, this, if I remember right, this is John Franklin's first feature film. But I think the reason that character works so well, and you're right, it had to be extremely difficult to cast this because you have to find a kid that has that sort of presence, right? And they just got lucky with John Franklin because, you know, like you said, he was about 23, 24, something like that at the time. But being an adult, he was able to kind of bring that, you know, he's able to bring that more mature presence to it, but have it sort of come out of a very, like, childlike physical form, right? You know, so there's just something that's just very, like, unsettling about it, especially with his performance. And yeah, I'm just going to keep rambling about that, but he's great in this film.
But he's not the only one. I think Courtney Gaines, who plays Malachi, he's also a standout as well. And you could tell he is fully 110% committed to this character. Like, he steals the entire movie. And, like, he is over the top, but it's a very modern menacing over the top. Like, it's complete contrast to Isaac. Like, Malachi, I always kind of forget that Malachi and, even though he is, like, a henchman of Isaac, what I think is interesting about the film is that over the course of it, you can see that Isaac and Malachi's relationship is starting to strain. And Malachi, to the point where Malachi thinks that Isaac is not a 100% true believer as much as he is, which is kind of ironic, being that Isaac is the one who brought He Who Walks Behind the Rose to these children in this town. And it becomes even more of an extremist than Isaac, which I think is pretty interesting.
Yes, and... yes it is.
but overall, I think, it is a watchable movie and it is quite enjoyable. But at the same time, I wouldn't go out of my way to say it's a quality movie. But but compared to, like, from what I remember of the sequels, this one's definitely the more memorable one of all. I mean, there's a whole episode of South Park that's basically remakes this entire movie.
Where is your husband?
Satan!
All right, I got the book for you.
Awesome!
Now can I please have the cell phone?
Sure, Outlander. I'll get it.
Outlander! Outlander! We have your woman! She still lives, Outlander! Outlander! Her blood was spared!
Well, what the heck are you talking about?
Better calm down, all right?
It does.
Which is pretty amazing.
So, you know, because... because I agree with you, I don't think it's a very well-made movie. You know, it's got a lot of problems. I mean, even just for starters, the fact that Bert and Vicky spend the first hour of this movie basically just driving in circles. You know, it's not a particularly well-made movie. There are really good elements of it, and that's why I just find it so interesting that it did have such a cultural impact because. You know, ever since this film came out, I mean, there are people out there, including myself, maybe because I grew up in the Midwest and drove by cornfields a lot, but, you know, it influenced a lot of people in the sense that a lot of us are now, I think about this movie every time I drive by a cornfield. There's just something that's very, that stands out about this premise. You know, it's just so creepy, the idea of this force that we don't know anything about that just lingers in this cornfield fucking up all these kids, right?
Yeah. Definitely. Something like that.
But Marcy, tell us your thoughts on Children of the Corn, because I know you have much more of a history of this movie than neither Matt and I do.
Oh, do I? Okay. well, probably about the same... I probably saw it about the same time as you, being in high school, wanting to watch horror movies and Stephen King and all of that stuff. So I think I saw it very early on. And even on that first watch, like, I thought this movie was fucking hilarious. there was so much I just found so funny. It just was so silly. You know, it was one of the first DVDs I owned because I just loved this movie so much for all the wrong reasons. It was one of my first sort of so bad it's good movies. So, yeah, I've definitely seen it quite a few times, but up until rewatching it for this podcast, it'd been a few years since I'd seen it. So I guess this is kind of like given me more interest in Children of the Corn again. But what do I actually think, aside from it being fucking hilarious? I agree with the points that you guys have made, like, especially with, like, John Franklin and Courtney Gaines. Like, I think they are the standouts in this film, and they play their roles really, really well. And I think, look, just in contrast, because I read the short story, like, years and years ago, so I didn't remember it. So I reread it before we did this podcast. And it was just making me ponder, like, you know, there are quite a bit of changes and additions because it is a short story. Whereas, as we'll discuss soon, the TV remake stays closer to that. But it makes you wonder whether that was a good idea or, you know, having the changes that they've done here was better. And there's arguments for both sides, but in this case, like in the short story, it's just Vicky and Bert arguing and being horrible to each other. At least here, they're not like that. So they're not as annoying, I suppose. Like, it's still, you're still with them forever in the car because they don't know what the hell they're doing. But at least that's cut between seeing what's happening in Gatlin and sort of a bit of the backstory with the kids and stuff. Whereas the story doesn't have any of that. And I think that kind of just adds a little bit extra into the movie. It makes it a bit more mysterious as you find out more and more. But essentially that short story, like Isaac and Malachi are in it in the last like few paragraphs. And that's it. Whereas here, there's a lot more, and it delves in a lot more, so it could flesh out more of a story rather than just have two people arguing in a car for 90 minutes. So, yeah, I found that aspect interesting. It is not really a good movie. It is an entertaining movie. And I think, like, the story itself is actually really, really good. I definitely understand what King was going for with it. And, yeah, not surprised, obviously, it got a movie, but I am surprised it got a billion and one sequels. Because I didn't really know where you could have gone with it, why it's so fascinating. Like, I don't think worshipping corn is particularly scary. For me, it just comes off more silly. And a lot of the corn paraphernalia, for me, just looks very silly. And for that kind of stuff to be the thing that they go on and on with, yeah, but I kind of like that he who walks behind the rose is something we really don't know. We can just assume what it could be. And yeah, it just kind of, I guess in the short story, I think Vicky says something like, oh, so they call God he who walks behind the rose here in Nebraska or something like that. Yeah, so movie, not so good. Entertainment factor, very good. Corn paraphernalia, kind of stupid. But I think it's interesting, though, that this film kind of added in a bit more stuff with the kids in that we see the two, I think they're siblings, and the girl draws the pictures of what's to happen. None of that's in the story. Right. And I found that a very interesting sort of element to kind of add on to it.
Although, I gotta say, Marcy, now that you sort of bring in those two up, because the boy, I keep forgetting his name. Is it Job? That's the boy's name? I keep forgetting.
I think it was Job and Sarah, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, like, he narrates the movie, but his narration is so happy-go-lucky compared to everything that's happening in the movie, particularly the very first scene, which is the massacre at the diner. Which is actually a legit chilling
it's
scene.
It's actually a pretty decent scene.
Yeah, but then when you have his narration, like, beforehand and over it, He's like, oh yeah, all this stuff happened, oh, whatever.
His hand got shoved into a grinder, you know, it was a bad day.
He's just so happy about it. And it's kind of, Ivo just like, you're not taking this scene very seriously, but then in like, maybe he is taking it seriously, but he's just so happy about it, like he's even more evil. I'm not sure. But it's, but it was just so weird, that narration. It just, and how he sort of approached it, because it's, it wasn't very good.
Yeah, it's not.
It is at not. All. You can probably get this out if you want to, but we do spoilers, right?
Oh yeah, this is a spoiler podcast, so yes.
Okay. Speaking of that, I do find it really interesting how Bert and Vicky just decide to adopt Sarah and Joe.
Yes.
Because I mean, you know, let's skip over like all of the just raw elements of that and the paperwork and all that stuff, but just on the simple fact of are you sure that Job and Sarah had nothing to do with any of the deaths in this town? I mean, all of the adults are dead. How do you know they had nothing to do with that?
They don't. Yeah. I think I want a director's cut of this movie.
Yes.
Oh, God.
I'm just saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jeez. But yeah. That's the thing, though. It's like, it's funny how, like, I think you both have already said, just like how this movie, which could easily have been just kind of forgotten, but due to how, because I know this movie got ripped apart when it came out by critics and all that, and I think it did moderately well at the box office, but it's kind of interesting that this whole movie has taken on a whole life of its own, and the fact that it is, you know, spawned so many sequels, and now, as at the time of recording this episode, there's a brand new one coming out, which is a total remake for theatrical release, which we'll talk about a bit later. It's kind of interesting that there's, you know, still a demand for all things Children of the Corn. And it's kind of interesting just how that, like, the legacy of this film has kind of impacted horror cinema ever since it was released.
This is not a movie I would have expected would have had one sequel, let alone 50,000 of them.
Mm.
And we watched, like, I've seen some of them, I don't really remember, but we watched the second one. When was that made? 1992?
Eight years later, yeah.
Children of the Corn 2, The Final Sacrifice, and it's so hokey and silly. Like, it's meant to take place, like, directly after the events of the movie, but then they're adding in all these people and, like, a town that's nearby, and I'm like, and these people never knew what was going on in Gatlin?
Nah, they didn't have phones back then, you know. So.
Like, no one went through the town, and when they're, you know, when you see them driving in the original, it's so far away from everything, and then the sequel, the town is like, you know, you could walk to the town in a second that's next to it. It's a bit silly. I'm just saying.
But even then, just like all these sequels, like, the people who pop up in these sequels is insane. I'm legit shocked, like, looking back over some from now, like, who was in them. Like, the third film has, like, Nicholas Brendon from Buffy, but also Charlize Theron was an extra on that movie, and you actually see her in the movie. And it was, like, the first thing she had ever done when she came to the US. And, like, the fourth one had Naomi Watts as the lead, and Karen Black was in it, too. The fifth movie had, like, Eva Mendes, and also had Fred Williamson and David Carradine in the supporting cast. And, of course, John Franklin comes back to play Isaac in the sixth movie, which he also co-wrote. And also Stacey Keach was in that movie, too.
Let's just say this, all right? Children of the Corn 666, Isaac's Return, is worth watching. And I used to have it on VHS. I might still have it on VHS somewhere.
Now, is it just worth watching because of John Franklin?
Yes, it actually is a decent sort of sequel on from it. Like, I found it watchable. But me and Bede and I do plan on watching all the sequels. So when I revisit it, I will still say it's amazing.
Or amazing for all the wrong reasons.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so after our life deep dive into the movie, like, Matt, I'm assuming you've read the short story as well.
I have. It's been years, but I have read it.
Yeah. Do you think, like, as I mentioned before, like, the changes they've made for this one, do you think they were probably for the better?
I mean, I would think so, because, I mean, you all pretty much ran through some of the bigger points already. Like, we don't... It would have been a very different film if we had just stuck with these two driving around forever, right? And then just meet the cast of kids in the end. And if I remember correctly, I don't think that Job and Sarah are really even in the short story. Is that correct? No,
they are not.
Right. And I like their inclusion, you know, because they kind of give us a look into this, a deeper look into the society that He Who Walks Behind the Rose and these kids and Isaac have created. Because, you know, there's I was thinking about this earlier today, and there's the whole rule of not having any games or toys and stuff like that. And, you know, I was trying to think of, like, well, why would that be? And I guess when you look at, you know, other sort of totalitarian societies, which is kind of what this is, you know, I mean, it's basically, you know, one rule or one person rules all sort of thing, you know. It's because, you know, the more creativity and, I guess, fun that you allow, like, the more people kind of open up their minds to different ideas, right? So I kind of like that inclusion and how it sort of gives you this look into it of, you know, just how just authoritarian this sort of cult is. The one change I would have been, that I think would have made the movie better had it not been changed, though, is I actually kind of would have liked to have seen the sort of darker ending that the short story has. Mm. And I'm not saying it has to go exactly like that, but the way that Children ends as it is, you know, it's just very silly. I mean, they, you know, they're adopting the kids. They're basically still leaving the dead body of that other kid in the trunk.
And
I would have been really curious to see what kind of impact it would have had they sort of gone with the little bit more sinister ending to this.
Which is what they did in the TV movie remake.
Oh, I'm curious then on how that plays, because I haven't seen it in forever.
So, Bede.
Yes.
What would your rating for Children of the Corn 1984 be?
Well, when I first saw this movie, it was definitely a 1 out of 5. But I think since then, I've warmed up a lot to it. So I think I'm going to give it at least a 2.5 out of 5. Like, it is like I said, it's definitely not a good movie. It's not even a very well-made movie. But it is an enjoyable one, and it is pretty memorable. And you know what? At the end of the day, even if a movie is bad, as long as it's memorable, that's enough for me.
Fair enough. Matt, what about your rating?
So I'll explain mine, since it's a bit higher than Bede's. mine is a 3.5 out of 5, and for me, 3.5 to just basically, like, it's a little bit above average, and just it's a watchable movie. You know, like, I can revisit Children of the Corn and not be bored. I have a good time with it. So I just consider 3 average. So for me, 3.5 is like, I can revisit this and have fun with it. So, but no, it's not by the common definition good.
And what about you, Marcy?
I would give it probably a 3, mostly due to how silly it can be. I find it very enjoyable and silly, but I do like some of the other bits in it, obviously, Isaac and Malachi and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I'd say for a movie that's not great, it's getting a 3, which means, yeah, I do enjoy it. And, yeah, I mean, it's a movie where Courtney Gaines yells, "Outlander, we have your woman." That's worth three stars, man.
Exactly.
And yes, so that wraps up that movie. We will move right along to Children of the Corn 2009. The
somebody was watching me.
Maybe someone was.
We gotta get out of here!
Time of judgment is now at hand.
What do you want?
I'm coming to give you peace.
I think it was for sci-fi.
Yeah, it was for the sci-fi channel, yeah.
Yes.
Sci-fi channel, they'll make anything.
Yes. This one stars David Anders as Bert, Candice McClure as Vicky, Preston Bailey as Isaac, Daniel Newman as Malachi. So, this one on IMDb, it says, while traveling, an unhappy married couple encounter a cult of murderous children who worship an entity called He Who Walks Behind the Rose. Saying that they're an unhappy couple is one way to describe it. Yep. Look, I'll just get my thoughts out on this one. While I made mention, this is a lot more faithful to the short story in a lot of ways. Not necessarily a good thing, because when you spend an hour with a couple that are just arguing and being horrible to each other, whereas you can read those passages in the book in 10, 15 minutes, it doesn't quite work. And, you know, there's... Look, well, I think David Anders is pretty solid as Bert. Candice McClure is very mixed as Vicky, but they don't have chemistry, and the arguing just gets very annoying very quickly. And a lot of their dialogue is actually directly from the story, and I just don't think in this way it translated well at all, because you... Like, the book kind of makes you side with both of them. You could see both sides to what was happening. And here I don't feel like you do. You're definitely like, you hate Vicky. She's overly annoying and stupid, and you're sort of like on Bert's side. Whereas I think the short story, you're not really divided like that. And other things in this movie... The kid they got for Isaac, Preston Bailey, yeah, he looks the right age in it, but it's a child performance where he's just reading cue cards. There's nothing sinister about him. It's completely different to what John Franklin gave us. And Daniel Newman as Malachi, again, the whole thing just doesn't work. Whereas Courtney Gaines, there was something there. Whereas this one, it just not much of a performance. And I don't know if anyone really works that well in this one. But yeah, as I said, it is a lot more faithful to the story. And it does keep that ending. So it does end on this, like, very downer of an ending where... obviously the spoilers. Once they're in the town and the kids come up on their car and they kill Vicky, but you don't see that. And they pretty much are trying to get Bert, but they don't, until he ends up in the middle of the cornfield after being chased by them. And then he sees Vicky is dead, but then he also sees, I think, the minister and the policeman from the town that have also been, like, sacrificed, killed there. And, yeah, Bert's fate is, well, not great. This version, I think, used some stuff from the original, like the having, you know, the kids in it more, giving, you know, that insight into Isaac Malachi, a little bit more into the cult and stuff. But a lot of the other stuff was very accurate to the book, but I just don't think it was executed in a way that worked. So this one is a big mess. And for me, I just really don't think it works. I mean, there was something that could have been good here, but I think maybe some casting changes, a different director could have seen something a bit different. Maybe another rewrite of the script. That's how I feel. Anyway.
Well, it'd probably make you happy to know that this was Donald P. Borscher's last film, so...
But the interesting thing is, though, he actually was the producer on the very on the 84 version of Children of the Corn, which I find very interesting.
But he also produced Highlander 2: The Quickening.
Well, that kind of says everything.
I can't forgive him for that. I'm sorry. But he is an executive producer on Children of the Corn 2021.
Oh, well, see, that scares me.
He just can't get away from this story.
But he also produced Leprechaun 2.
Okay.
Yes.
Just saying. Anyway.
Dumb, but fine.
Yes, after my rant about this movie, Bede.
Yes.
Please enlighten us with your thoughts on this one.
Well, where to start with this remake of Children of the Corn? I think as a film, it's actually well made. Like, it's got a good polish to it, but I also like... But what I find interesting about this film, and what he does at least an interesting job with it, is that unlike, say, the 84 version, this one's actually a period piece. Because the story begins in 1963.
64,
sorry.
Like the short story.
I know, right? with Isaac sort of in this sort of tent, sort of preaching to the children. And then, of course, that'll lead them with killing the adults. But they don't show that scene in this movie, which is kind of interesting. But then we kind of flash forward to 1975, where we follow Bert and Vicky. And what's really struck me out, because I did see this movie when it came out, and also now having rewatched it again, what really struck me out about this remake is the aesthetic of it, because it's very clear that this film, since it is set in the 70s, they go for that kind of 70s visual style and look to it, especially with a lot of horror films from the 2000s that were made around that time. Like,
see,
you know,
like, I didn't have a problem with that part of it. Like, it does look pretty decent. It does have that feel to it, but there's just something off.
Yeah, like, it's it actually reminded me of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake and its prequel, The Beginning. Like, just in terms of visual style. And going for that sort of bit more sort of grittier sort of 70s look with, you know, looking like it's kind of shot at, the entire movie was shot at sunset as well. Which I think actually helped the movie on a visual level. But unfortunately, though, I think what the major problem for me was the film spends its time way too much on Bert and Vicky and their relationship. And the fact that... I don't mind couples arguing in a film. Like, some of my favorite films of all time are about, you know, marriages crumbling and stuff like that. But the thing is, we just don't... They're so awful to each other that we just don't care what happens to them. And the movie really does go out of its way for us to really hate Vicky the most.
I can't make sense of this. I'm sure there's people here.
You know what? That's what's wrong with you. You're always sure. You spent your whole life being sure. Why do you have to be so stubborn? Why can't you just admit that there's something wrong here? The whole place stinks of it. I'm sorry.
Why don't we just go find some local authorities and report this accident? Okay?
Shh, no. No. There, I said it. No. And in a nutshell, why our entire marriage is falling apart, Bert. I said no. No, sir.
Just give it a rest.
I'll give it a rest when we're going the other way, okay? Now turn this car around. Turn it around right now and let's go and see that lawyer.
We have a dead child in the trunk of our car. If you want to go back to I-80 and walk, that's fine. I'll pick you up later. But do not tell me to drive 70 miles backwards and act like we have nothing but a bag of garbage in our trunk. This kid was some mother's son, Vicky. So I'm going to find whatever local justice they have around here and report it before whoever killed him is over the hills and far away. Is that fine by you?
Yes, sir. Yes, Captain, sir. I forgot we were back in Long Dong or Dung Ho, wherever it was that you won the war. Must have been the Kong, sir. Why don't we go back in there, burn a few hooches, and rape a few grandmothers, huh?
Why don't you stop talking for a while? And put that down. Put it down!
You play your games and I'll play mine.
Oh, of course. That's always the way you play it. Let's remember, we got a prom queen to take care of here.
Like, I don't know whether it's because of Candace's performance or not, because her performance is literally all over the place, and her character, in terms of how she's crafted, is very just so jumbled. Like, she's like, she acts one way and then completely acts the opposite, like literally 2 seconds later. And while Anders, at least, even though his character's a complete arsehole too, but he really downplays it. But also, like you say, the kids, I mean, I don't want to be mean to Preston Bailey because, you know, he was a child star at the time, and, you know, child actors can only do as much as you can with them. But unfortunately, yeah, he just doesn't have the presence of somebody like John Franklin had. And like you say, it just seemed like he was like reading off cue cards. Like, the thing is, especially in the scenes where he's talking to the other kids and preaching a sermon and that, it, like, the whole point of when you got a character like that is you got to at least get why the followers follow that person, because they kind of need to rouse them up and sort of like be commanding and charismatic on stage. But Preston Bailey, unfortunately, just doesn't have any of that. No. And the fact that his line readings come off as very stilted and bland. Like, if I was one of those kids during those meetings and that, I would be like, okay. And then just walk off. Like, you're just not transfixed by, like, what he is selling. And also just the stuff with the actual kids themselves, but kind of feels like put in the background just compared to Bert and Vicky's relationship, because that seems what the film is more focused on.
Mm.
But I think it's interesting, though, because I think from what I read, like doing my research and all that, Stephen King's actually a co-writer on this movie, but yet doing my research, he had nothing to do with this film. So I thought, okay, how can that be? But apparently he actually wrote a draft for the original 84 film that wasn't used. And I think Donald P. Borchers, he wrote the film, but I think he must have used Stephen King's original script for the 84 film, which apparently was a lot more closer to his original story, and kind of rewrote it to update it for now. So, even though I haven't read the short story itself, I give the movie credit for at least taking a different approach from the 84 film, but at the same time, it's just kind of a slog to watch.
Yeah.
So what you two are basically saying with the Children of the Corn franchise, it's John Franklin or bust.
Pretty much.
Yeah, so...
Pretty much.
I mean, like I said, I mean, visually, it looks really good. But yeah, I think that's kind of my big takeaway, was more of the visual style of it. And also, there's some weird elements about this as well. Like, there is a weird sex scene that all the kids watch in the church, which is just bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was included in the short story or not.
That sounds like a...
Nope!
Yeah, it's like, I guess because... It's interesting because this movie, like, it's set about, like, 11, 12 years after, say, when Isaac first arrives in town, but the kids don't age, and it's never explained why they don't age. I guess you could say, oh, it's because of He Who Walks Behind the Rose, but it's never really commented on, and, like, just some of the weird stuff as well, and, like I said, back to that sort of weird sex scene, it's like... Like, because they need to have more followers. So anyone who's basically is about to turn 17 or 18, they need more children for the cult. So they basically have to do this kind of ritual. Like, the oldest children have to do this kind of ritualistic sex scene where everyone watches. And even though it's a bit tastefully done, it is weird and creepy and I didn't like watching it. Because mainly it's just for the fact that these kids are watching, I bet it's just, like, weird and off-putting.
It's messed up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
It isn't fun, let me tell you.
Yeah, and also it kind of delves into Bert's backstory, because I think it kind of, he was like, at least in this version, I don't know if it is in the original short story, that he's a Vietnam vet.
Yeah, it is mentioned in it.
Yeah, so I guess they sort of wanted to delve into that more, especially when he gets lost out in the field because he has, like, these flashbacks and everything like that. But it really doesn't add anything to the movie. And when it sort of ends on its very bleak note, it just feels like, oh, that's it.
Mm.
Like this
but
is a
do you know what we haven't mentioned?
What's that?
We discovered this movie has a scene after the credits.
I know. I did not know this until we actually watched it the other day.
I had no idea.
There's an entire 5-minute scene at the end after the credits of this movie.
It's 5 minutes?
It is pretty long. It's actually a very long scene. And I honestly don't know why they have an after the credits scene. I guess to kind of... The filmmaker probably thought, oh, well, if this movie is successful on the Sci-Fi Channel, we could probably make more sequels. Mm.
10 more sequels.
Yeah, 10 more sequels, which is kind of ironic because the straight to DVD franchise had 2 more sequels after this one, but I digress. But it's just a weird scene that, again, doesn't add anything to the movie, I guess, except for setting up a future installment.
It kind of has a bit more to do with how the short story ends, where Malachi goes into the corn, leaving a pregnant girl behind.
Yeah.
Who's questioning whether this is the right thing.
Well, I guess to give credit to the movie, like the Donald B. Botchers kind of went out of his way to actually cast age-appropriate actors for this movie, because you can tell these are all kids. Except for the actor who plays Malachi, Daniel Newman. I think reading up on him, he was like 29 at the time he made this movie. So he's practically nearly 30, a nearly 30-year-old Malachi in this film.
Yeah.
But actually what was interesting, because I think I didn't realize this, because watching the film, Candace McClure, I kept watching her and thinking, where have I seen her before? Like, I'd seen her in something recently, but I didn't know what it was. But then when I looked up her IMDb page, I was stunned to find out that this film is actually the second of 2 TV remakes of Stephen King properties, because she played Sue Snell in the 2002 remake of Carrie.
Yeah, I completely forgot she was in that.
Yeah, another remake that we can forget.
Actually, that one, I think, well, I mean, when we watched that movie for that episode, which was our very first episode of King Zone, it's actually a lot better than I remembered. Which is kind of surprising.
From what I can gather.
Yeah, it's better than this, and she's actually pretty good in that one, but yeah, the material she has in this one did not suit her talents at all.
Yeah, nah, just doesn't work. So, Bede, what do you rate this one?
I'm going to, like I said, there are certain aspects of it I thought were solid, particularly the visual style. But yeah, this one was a bit of a slog to sit through. I'm going to give it at least 1.5 out of 5.
Yeah, I think I'm sitting on the same. I think 1.5. Like, it could have been a lot better, but it just doesn't really work.
But I will say this, though. Like, even though it's definitely a bad film, I would say, for those out there who are curious, definitely give it a watch just to see what, I guess, what this story would have been like if it was faithfully adapted. But just
faithfully adapted with a cast that probably works better together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the question is, Matt, I know you didn't get a chance to watch this before the podcast. Have we enticed you to be at least somewhat curious to check this remake out?
I mean, I already give it 5 stars for driving the two of you nuts, so... no, I mean, yeah, absolutely. It's... I mean, that's the thing. I can't even remember if I have seen it. I just know it hasn't been any time recently. But I'm definitely enticed to, because it is an interesting story. I think, like you said, if it's a closer adaptation, I'd certainly be curious to give it a watch. Especially since, like I mentioned, I am curious to see how the grimmer ending plays out. So,
yeah.
No, with any remake of a classic like this, I think there's always a bit of curiosity that, you know, any fan should check it out to kind of just see what a different interpretation is like.
Definitely.
Jinx. And that now brings us to the Dollar Baby short film, which was made before any other of the film, called Disciples of the Crow.
Where are we anyway?
Oklahoma.
I know we're in Oklahoma, Bert, but where are we?
Well, you've got the map. Why don't you look it up? Or can't you read?
Do you suppose we could stop for cigarettes? Or does your almighty schedule say we have to go on until 2 o'clock like yesterday?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, we can turn our lights off.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Vicky! You see me? You hear me? What? I want you to go back to the car. Bring me the blanket and my shotgun.
Your shotgun?
Yes. I may have run him over, but I didn't stick this into him. Somebody did.
You can look up Disciples of the Crow 1983 on YouTube, as it is there.
And sort of looked up this before we started the podcast. If you actually had the US Arrow Blu-ray of Children of the Corn, Disciples of the Crow is actually on there as a special feature to watch.
Oh, that is pretty cool. So, yeah, I don't really have a plot synopsis. I'm just trying to find one.
I found one.
All right. IMDb. A couple passing through small town Oklahoma discover that it has been taken over by a homicidal cult that worships a crow god, and all the cult members are children.
Yes.
And there is no Malachi or Isaac. I think this just goes by a preacher called Billy,
who, funnily enough, is played by the film's writer-director, John Woodward, which I'm, looking up right now.
Yeah,
the older version, yes.
It does have Vicky and Bert, and this one changes a lot, but pretty much follows the same basic thing where it's a couple passing through a town, and then they soon discover all the sinister things going on in said town.
Kind of plays like a much shorter version of what you two just described for the remake, you know, where it's a lot of Bert and Vicky just tearing into each other.
Yeah. Which always seems to be the way. But look, it was not a bad short film. Can get, you know, the changes they made, okay. Make a bit more sense, put more into the kind of religious element of it. Yeah, obviously it doesn't have a big budget, but I think they really made it work with what they had. And it ends on a very weird note. Interesting to say, like, all these three films have different endings.
Indeed. I think, when was the last time we ever seen a bunch of movies have completely different endings? It might have actually been for this podcast, I think. But I think it's interesting just seeing these three interpretations of it, because they all take a different approach while also in some aspects stay faithful, from the sounds of it, to the original story.
Mm. Yeah.
But continue, Marcy.
I don't know. That was pretty much all I had to say on that. I was more interested to hear what you guys had to say about it.
But Matt, you go first.
I'll just throw in that, you know, despite like you're talking about with the remake, you know, my lack of interest in Bert and Vicky just arguing a bunch and Bert being a misogynistic dick, I do really like the way that it's shot. And, you know, like you're saying, Marcy, they didn't have a low budget, they didn't have a good budget on it, but they did kind of everything that they could, I think, visually to really make it work. You know, something I really like about it is being made in 83 and kind of being shot in that, you know, sort of summer heat Nebraska setting. It really reminded me in a weird way of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where the entire thing just feels very just kind of like gritty and dirty, you know, like you kind of want to take a shower after it.
Yeah.
And I do like that we get a bit into the religious element of it without having really anything explained to us, because it just makes the entire thing a bit creepier.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially for being made in 1983, you know, anyone who actually did see it at the time, I can only imagine just walking away from this being like, what the hell was that? And I want to know more about it. Because, you know, this is before anyone had seen the 1984 version, so they probably had no idea really what was going on in this.
Yeah. It's just a very creepy, unsettling little movie.
Yeah, I think that was what really struck me the most about it, is like, even though it's about, I'm not going to say it's the most amazing short I've seen, but I have to give it a lot of credit, because, like you said, it's definitely got this eerie, creepy tone throughout it, and it consistently has that from beginning to end, which really impressed me. And like you said, Matt, the first thought I did have, it had that sort of, which I agree with you, is that it had that sort of Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibe to it.
Right.
And yeah,
just very just hot and sweaty and dirty. And
oh, yeah. And it was just kind of interesting seeing the fact that, you know, this short film like came out literally a year before the remake. So pretty much, and it's kind of an interesting in that way. But as a short film itself, like I said, it's well made. It's got pretty good creepy tone. Even the actors who do play Bert and Vicky are Gabriel Fosse and Elise Lester. I thought they were both solid in their roles.
They weren't bad, yeah.
And it pretty much covers, like, even though it only goes for about 18 minutes, it pretty much covers most, like, all the beats of the previous plots of the films, like, just hitting those kind of specific marks. And there is some pretty creepy moments in it. And I found it was interesting, like, they kind of changed it in a way, not being this, He Who Walks Behind the Rose is like this sort of entity, but in fact that they, instead of entirely worshipping corn, they're worshipping crows instead.
Mm.
And there's a lot of crows in this movie, and how the film sort of ends, Bert and Vicky get out of town, but the thing is, like, that their car, they have one of the daggers there, like, from the kids, because they got, I think the dagger sort of got pierced, but their car got pierced by the dagger.
Yeah.
And they drive off.
Mm-hmm.
And they take the dagger with them, and then all of a sudden it's like all these hundreds and hundreds of crows just fly past the sun. And I guess it's in a way kind of insinuating, like, since they've taken a little bit of that town with them, the crows are going to follow them wherever they go.
Yeah, it's a very eerie ending, and I probably should have written this down because it really struck me, but Bert's last line is something along the lines of, he mentions something about the children, then says, unless that's what their God wanted, or something like that. And I just sort of took it kind of how you're describing Vita's, and just, they've escaped the town, but they haven't truly escaped.
Exactly.
You know? Like I took it as they are doomed to, you know, meet the so-called he who walks behind the rose, or whatever. They're not getting out of there alive.
Exactly. And but yeah, I think it's a pretty solid little short, and I think it's a good curiosity for anyone who is a fan of the Children of the Corn series, or just the 84 film alone. It's good to kind of see sort of an interesting sort of like early variation of this story and kind of doing its own little thing with it.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Bede, what's your rating for this one?
I give it a solid 3 out of 5. Like, I think I would have liked it if it was a couple minutes more, just so, you know, certain aspects of it could have been delved into just a tad more with the story. But for what it is, I really enjoyed it. And also just finding out about it, that, like, some more info on this short. Apparently it actually won a Student Academy Award for Merit.
Oh.
So, which is actually pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, and that's what I really enjoy about, like, watching a lot of these dollar baby kind of short films that Stephen King allows, you know, up and coming filmmakers to adapt any of his short stories for like a dollar, is just their interpretation of it. Particularly ones that if the same short story gets made into like a big budget Hollywood film. So it's interesting to kind of compare, kind of like we did with The Lawnmower Man and the original short film that was made a few years before it.
One that actually adapted the short story, unlike the feature film, which had nothing to do with it.
Exactly. but yeah, it's a solid short, and I'd say it's definitely worth checking out if anyone's interested.
Definitely worth checking out. I'll probably give it the same rating, 3 out of 5. It's very solid. The only thing I just thought was funny in this was that stupid bird thing.
Yes.
That Bobby Bird thing, yeah. Matt, what was your rating for this one?
I would also give it a 3 out of 5. I think it's a really solid short. And, you know, to the point where I looked up the director, and I was actually surprised to see that that John Woodward never really went on to do much other than a couple features every 10 years. Like, he's done 2 movies since this. And you know, there's a lot of potential in this short, so I'm kind of shocked by that, to be honest. But no, it's a solid short. Definitely worthwhile for anyone who's a fan of the franchise.
Yeah, and isn't it funny that the most, out of the 3 things we've watched, the most faithful one happens to be the one we gave the lowest score to.
It is interesting.
Yes, it is.
I guess sometimes the moral is, like, I mean, yeah, you could faithfully 100% adapt the story, but you don't necessarily need to.
I think there are things you should do and shouldn't do. Oh, well, yes. Yeah.
Right. I think part of the lesson there, too, is that, you know, there are 2 different art forms, you know, writing a novel or a short story, making a film. So that's why a lot of them make the changes that they do, because not everything that's written adapts well to screen. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and, sorry.
I was going to say before we wrap up, to sort of talk briefly about the new Children of the Corn film, which is
coming
out.
Yes, I was about to talk about that.
Go ahead, Marcy.
I was saying they're actually filmed it during the pandemic in Australia.
Yeah, they shot it in Australia, and that kind of blew my mind because it just came out of nowhere in a news article that, like, oh, yeah, there's a new Children of the Corn movie being shot in Australia, and I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it's directed and written by Kurt Wimmer.
Who is the writer and director of Equilibrium and Ultraviolet. So he's made one good movie and one not-so-good movie. But
yeah,
he's had
a very interesting choice there.
But he's had a pretty extensive career as a screenwriter because he wrote, like, Law Abiding Citizen, Salt, the Point Break remake.
It's interesting because he seems to traffic mostly in, like, you know, sci-fi action. Like, he just has a very different style from what I would expect from Children of the Corn.
Yeah. So this film looks like it's more of a prequel. The synopsis currently on IMDb, which I guess the production stuff was last updated June 2020. The film describes the events leading up to and including the massacre of the adults in a small town in Nebraska by their children after the adults' irresponsibility ruins the crop and the children's future. And in the full cast, I'm looking at character names, which are all there. I do not see a Vicky, a Bert, an Isaac, or a Malachi. I don't know if I can deal with it.
maybe they are, but just having different names. But I guess we'll just have to wait. But what really struck me most about this new film, like especially that synopsis, is like this new remake could have a lot of potential based on that synopsis because because it seems like they're going to tackle some very interesting at social and relevant themes, particularly with, you know, sort of like in our world right now, how it seems like the older generation are basically like ruining the planet through, you know, with pollution and all that. And what will happen to the younger generation? And we, the ones who have to deal with it, like in the future, because that is an interesting kind of way to kind of explore those themes in the guise of Children of the Corn. But I think, but then again, being Kurt Wimmer's sort of half and half as a filmmaker and screenwriter, so it could go either way. But I'm hoping for the best just based on that premise alone, because it definitely has a lot of potential. And the fact that Aussie actors like Callan Mulvey and the always legendary Bruce Spence, who's been like in every single franchise in existence, are in this movie.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. I guess we'll watch this space, but we will follow up this podcast when that film comes out with Children of the Corn 2021, when we review it, whenever it comes out, whenever we're free to leave the house.
Whenever we'll be birthing again.
And what do you think, Matt? What do you think about this, the idea of this new Children of the Corn film? Like, you excited or not excited or curious? Or
So I'm with you in the sense that, you know, I'm a little unsure of Kurt Wimmer being behind this personally. But that being said, you know, just reading the synopsis, I mean, the thing that jumps out immediately to me is global warming. You know, it's the very first thing I think of. And so I do think that the film has a lot of potential in being very timely. And again, I think is going to play very differently for different generations. You know, like, I think if the film is kind of going that route and discussing this idea of how the older generation has kind of ruined our livelihood, right? With pollution and destroying the planet and basically just ignoring everything. You know, I have a feeling that for a younger generation, this film could potentially play as very cathartic, maybe. And an older generation might look at this and you would hope that they can maybe sort of take a look from it and say, maybe I shouldn't be such a fuck up all the time.
Yeah. No, I mean, guess that's really we'll see.
Touch people in some kind of way like that. But no, I am very interested in that plot synopsis. It's actually my first time reading that, so.
And the fact that they shot this secretly in the middle while Australia was having a pandemic is kind of mind-blowing to me. But apparently they took very much safety precautions while filming it, which is always a good thing. But I'll be curious to see how the end result turns out, and I guess we'll all come back this time next year, depending on when it gets released, of course, to review this film and discuss it.
That is right. And yes, that wraps up our very interesting discussion on three adaptations of Children of the Corn. And good thing we're not discussing the sequels, because there's too many of them.
That could be for a later podcast.
But yes, that's a wrap. Thank you, Matt, for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, always, Brad.
Always a pleasure. And I'll update everybody, as I always try to do, on our socials. You can follow me at Supermasty. Let me try that again. You can follow me at twitter.com/supermarcy. You can follow the Super Network on Twitter at twitter.com/sm_thesupernetwork. You can join our Facebook page. Give us a like at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. You can go to Facebook and type in the Super Network group and join our Facebook group. You can subscribe to us at Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. We need more Patreons because we have to torture Bede.
Actually, Marcy, just as we were recording the show, I checked our website email, and we do, in fact, have a new patron.
We are one step closer.
And that is, of course, our good friend Haley, who's pledged $4. So we're going to give her a shout-out on this episode, because that's one of the perks of
we'll just continuously give her a shout out then.
Exactly.
How much money are you away from actual videos of Bede being tortured?
We did at least 10 subscribers, so we got 5, so we're now at the halfway point.
We sound pathetic. 5 subscribers.
Yeah, but we're slowly getting there.
Come on, people, come on,
you only have to pledge.
Make us look better. Just give us a dollar.
I mean, who doesn't want to see me wear my Nicolas Cage jumpsuit and do an impression of him reading Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven?
How could you not want to see that?
Exactly. This is going to be the best thing ever. And before I forget, you can subscribe to our podcast via iTunes, Stitcher, CastBox, and Spotify. And of course, you can go to supermarcy.com and stream from there. Bede, where can people find your socials if they want to? Wait. I forgot one very important thing.
What's that?
But it is not on my list of things, because someone probably stuffed up the post.
Uh-oh.
Send hate mail to address to Bede at thesupernetworksm@gmail.com.
Whoops. Sorry about that. It's not like I subconsciously did that so nobody could send me hate mail.
Are you sure now?
Uh-oh. if anyone wants to find me, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeeJamine, or my personal writer's page at facebook.com/TerribleAussie. You can also find all my reviews and columns over at supermarcy.com. Haven't written much in a while, but hopefully I will soon. We'll see how that goes. It's a bit hard to review anything when there's... when there's nothing new out at the moment, but I'll get back into it very soon with either written or audio reviews. But also, you can also check out my column Horror Down Under over at the Screamcast. And also, yeah, I think that's pretty much it. You can just find me on Twitter, or just email me all your hate mail at as well.
Yes, and Matt, what are your socials?
So first off, you can find my writing, as well as a bunch of other writers who write for us, at killerhorrorcritic.com. Just covers everything horror and sci-fi and whatever you can want there. You can follow me on Twitter at killerfromspace, and follow my rantings on horror and horror news and all of our reviews and everything there. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/killerhorrorcritic. We could always use more as well. We have bonus episodes for the podcast that my wife and I do, as well as bonus content for each of them, which is typically me at my most drunk. Ranting about different things as I tend to drink during the show, so by the time we get to the bonus stuff, I'm pretty out of my mind. So, we could always use the more there as well. And you can email me at killerhorrorcritic@gmail.com. I'm always open to jump on podcasts when I actually have a fucking free minute for once.
Oh, no, don't worry. You'll be back many times for the show, love to say.
And send me hate mail Bede's way. Don't email me.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And, yes, that wraps up our podcast. Thank you for listening, everybody. Thank you to me for being wonderful, as always. Not so much a thank you to Bede, because you're terrible. But thank you, Matt, for joining us once again.
You are the best. Not Bede.
No.
I am the best.
Okay.
I don't know how I was going to end the podcast. I was going to say, now remember, just be warned, if Courtney Gaines starts yelling, Outlander, we have your woman, because there's trouble brewing.
Exactly.
Catch you later, everyone.
See you, everyone. Bye.
Outlander! Come on! Come on, Outlander!